Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. We often turn to friends and family first when we need someone to lean on, or at least we'd like to turn to them first. But sometimes it's people from the periphery of our lives who step up in challenging moments. That's what happened to Randy Davenport. Andrea Martin stars in the NBC sitcom Great News. She reads Randy's essay about a connection that Randy says saved her life.
He lifted his glasses and let them rest on his forehead before taking hold of my right leg. "Pull me closer," he said. I pulled. "Push me away." I pushed. I thought, this is the game lovers play. Pull me closer. Push me away. Each action holding the promise of a specific outcome. If I push you away, you will come after me. If I pull you closer, you will let me. But he wasn't my lover. He was my doctor. Then I felt my leg give way, a sensation of water running downhill. I came back to myself, to the blue-white light of the exam room, the crinkly sound of the paper on the table, the feeling of his hand on my skin as again he told me to pull him closer, to push him away. The sensation of weakness, this time in my left leg. He made no comment, but I saw the studied flatness of his expression. I looked down at the shrunken muscles in my feet, at my paralyzed toes. And then I looked up at him. He reached into his lab coat, pulled out his reflex hammer, and took aim at my knee. My leg jumped, the spasm of a too brisk response. "You are fine," he said. "Trust me." I tried to trust him, but I wasn't fine, and we both knew it. My motor neurons were failing. They had been failing for 2 decades, slowly, in a sleepy subterranean wave. I knew I was lucky. Motor neuron disease is incurable, and most people who have it die within a year or two, maybe 5. But I was still alive, soldiering on. So when my doctor said I was fine, he meant he had discovered nothing new and alarming during this exam. I was holding steady. I wasn't fine, but I wasn't dying either. We met every 3 months. The regularity of these appointments and the close monitoring that the schedule suggested should have terrified me. Instead, it made me feel safe. As time passed, I realized it wasn't just the monitoring that brought me comfort, but the doctor himself. I liked the way he wore his hair cut short, so I could see the contours of his skull. I liked the shape of his hands and the patient way he answered my questions. And if I hesitated, not wanting to talk about embarrassing symptoms, he would soften his voice and give me a mild look. "Tell me," he'd say. And I'd tell him. One night I dreamed of him standing in the middle of a wasteland, a world exploded by war, his sleeve pushed back so I could see the watch on his wrist. The dial read 10 minutes to eight. In the dream, I thought, oh, thank God, I still have time. But when I woke up, I felt only terror. Time's running out, I thought. I sent my doctor an email, and he responded right away. "Do not worry," he wrote. "You are fine." I felt the force of his words, the shelter of his certainty. It's axiomatic to say that patients with serious illnesses fall in love with their doctors, seeing them as points of light in an otherwise dismal sky. But I knew this wasn't love. It was desperation, a fingerhold on a cliff before the fall. I wasn't in love with him, but I had come to depend on him. I was accustomed to taking care of myself, and I had let him take care of me. I let him see that I was scared. And when I let him see my fear, I had to see it too. My own fragility, the stuff I couldn't just power through. Despite this, he gave me hope. This was the ammunition that fueled my fight. "Pull me closer," he said each time we met. "Push me away." I asked about his family in Syria. "You don't want to hear this," he said, as formal and as courteous as ever. But eventually he told me about his reckless nephews, his brother-in-law with cancer, his mother and sisters who remained there, watching daily for things that could fall from the sky, bombs, pieces of aircraft, the flotsam of war. Inadvertently, I winced and turned away. When I looked at him once more, he was watching me recoil from things unknown. "You are fine," he said, and smiled. Not long after, 3 Muslim students were shot in our town, killed when they answered a knock at their apartment door. In San Bernardino, California, a newly married couple, their toddler at her grandmother's house, opened fire in a room full of county office workers. And all the news was about shooters from ISIS, Muslims, and the threat they posed to the American way of life. At my next appointment, I could tell my doctor was preoccupied. "What's wrong?" I asked softly. "It is nothing," he said. He wouldn't look at me. I thought about the way he had come to America and chosen to work at a big state teaching hospital so he could help poor people, how he had come here to be safe and to offer safety. I had never seen him look as defeated as he did now. "Tell me," I said. He hesitated and then said he was afraid for his wife and children. He would be fine, but he worried about them. "People are crazy," he said. And then he began to talk about leaving America, maybe moving to Dubai. "You will break my heart," I said. I thought I was joking, but a minute later I was weeping. I understood why he wanted to leave, but I also knew that if I was still alive, it was because of him. His bravery mattered when mine faltered. His mantra, "You are fine, you are fine," cut through my doubt when it seemed there was no light. How many effects of warfare are invisible, revealed only in human trembling, that shivering language of fear? The twitching, failing muscle, the bullet in the air. each equivalent to the other, it turns out, when the coming damage is unknown, but certain. I wanted him to be safe, the same thing he wanted for me. And I knew I was helpless to procure that safety for him, because some people are, indeed, crazy. And he was just as helpless when it came to halting the march of my illness. I said his name, and he turned to face me. "I am with you," he said, as if I had asked him for something, his voice fierce again, his face filled with resolve. "I am not going anywhere." "You're okay, too," I replied, wiping my eyes, knowing my words were futile but needing to say something anyway. "Nothing's going to happen," I said, even though I could not possibly know if he would be all right. Even so, I barreled on. "Your family will be all right. You'll be all right." He smiled gently and shook his head. And then I realized something. He had never once tried to reassure me about the future in that way, with false hope. He had only ever spoken about the present, telling me what he knew to be true. I was still fine. I was not yet headed for a quick death, and that was what had given me comfort. "You are fine," I offered softly, thinking that for at least this moment he was. But as soon as I said this, he flicked his glance away and did not reply. I did not blame him for ducking the conversation the way you would dodge a downpour of rain. We could hear nothing of war in that cool place, where the only sounds came from the elevators rising and falling. There were no bullets flying, no audible dying off of this neuron or the next. These things are silent until they are upon us, and by then it is too late. So we sat without speaking, together in the dark night of that bright room. But if he had taught me anything, it was that comfort resides in the rituals of care. The steady application of optimism, the shivering light of faith in the fact that I was still okay. And so I thought, what can I offer when the only thing I have is hope? And then you can be his patient. You can let him take care of you. Almost as soon as I thought this, he reached into his lab coat for his hammer. "Go like this," he said, cupping his fingers so that one hand hooked into the other. When I did, he told me to pull. Then he hit my knee with a hammer and resumed his exam.
Andrea Martin, reading Randy Davenport's essay, A Dose of Empathy from My Syrian Doctor. We'll catch up with Randy after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Before she found this doctor, Randy Davenport spent 7 years trying to learn why she was experiencing such extreme fatigue and losing her ability to walk. That search brought her to many different neurologists at top hospitals who told her that there was definitely something wrong, but they weren't sure what it was.
By the time I found the doctor about whom I wrote for the New York Times, I really was exhausted and felt alone and sort of desperate. And the very first day I met him, he told me that he knew what was wrong with me. And honestly, the relief that I felt, it's almost impossible to find the words to describe that relief. And then he just began to take care of me. And he knew what to do and how to do it and when to do it and what to offer. And gradually our friendship developed out of that.
The doctor explained to her that she had upper motor neuron disease, a very rare neuromuscular disorder.
I've been a single parent and I've handled lots of things on my own, most things in fact, but being alone with an illness that is gradually taking away your ability to function in the ways that you had previously functioned, that was really painful and very difficult. So here is this doctor who immediately made me feel like I could rely on him, that I could lean on him, that he would in some sense be my rock as I tried to battle forward with this illness. I mean, that's a very profound commitment that he made to me just by being my doctor.
But Randy's doctor eventually chose to leave North Carolina and is now practicing in the Pacific Northwest.
I think it was really heartbreaking for him to leave the patients with whom he developed relationships and who he took such careful and serious and responsible care of. But I think also incredibly, obviously, devastating for his patients when he left, to have somebody who was that brilliant in his field and that careful and compassionate with his patients, to have him leave. So now that he's gone and now that he's in the Pacific Northwest and I can't travel to see him, my world is a more frightening place.
But Randy says that he treated her for so long, much of what he told her stays with her.
Even though he is gone and even though I do feel his loss really profoundly, there is something about the way he took care of me that reminds me to be as optimistic as I can be every day and to remind myself that if the past is any predictor of the future, then I can be completely certain that the disease will continue to progress really slowly. Day to day, the things that I'm focused on probably aren't that important, and he certainly taught me that, not to sit home and worry about my symptoms and develop anxious responses to them because it's just not going to help me.
Although Randy is managing, thoughts of her doctor are never far. She often thinks about the journey he had to take to get to this country.
Like other doctors, he came here and had to kind of prove himself all over again and learn English and figure out a way to take care of people. And I think there are lots of doctors who come from other cultures who are probably doing the same kind of work, and we need to take care of them the way they take care of us. They're incredible treasures among us and are suffering, I think, as the current political winds blow, this idea of people from other countries and other cultures being too different for us to accommodate, when really many of them are here to help us.
That's Randy Davenport. She's a writer living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Her books include The End of Always and The Boy Who Loved Tornadoes. After the break, Modern Love editor Daniel Jones on what he took from Randy's piece and more from Andrea Martin.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
This doctor had the ability to give emotional comfort and treat physical symptoms. That's what Dan Jones says he loved most about this piece.
I just thought that the piece has a marvelous shift in perspective when it continues to be only about her and then makes this shift into his past and his fears for his family, and this revelation that in the current climate, he might just leave the United States and go to Dubai or wherever, take his skills and compassion elsewhere. Such a sad moment.
Andrea Martin explains why she chose to read Randy's essay.
I connected with my roots as an Armenian and what it must have been like for my grandparents to fit in, try to feel safe, try to bring a sense of safety to their community, and always looked upon as second-class citizens and not being able to go back where they were from because of a genocide committed there like it is in Syria. So I guess I really thought about my past, my heritage, and my culture.
Thanks again to Andrea Martin. You can see her in NBC's Great News. Next week, it's the 100th episode of Modern Love, the podcast. And to celebrate, we're going to hear from you.
I was completely unprepared for the Modern Love episode that broke me down.
I'm always living in fear around losing another part of myself.
And it really changed me. It changed my perspective on the job of what motherhood is, what impact your love and patience could have on the world.
And that question made me think about love and grief in so many new ways, and I will always be grateful for that.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.